Chapter 31. Your importance. He doesn't know anything of your social and political position, and still less of your great ambitions. Mr. Travers listened with some attention. Old you have enlightened him, he asked. He would have been no use. His mind is fixed upon his own position, and upon his own sense of power. He is a man of the lower classes. He is a brute, said Mr. Travers, obstinately, and for a moment those two looked straight into each other's eyes. H, said Mrs. Travers, slowly, you are determined not to compromise with your feelings. An undertone of scorn crept into her voice. Shall I tell you what I think? I think, and she advanced her head slightly toward the pale unshaven face that confronted her dark eyes. I think that for all your blind scorn you judge the man well enough to feel that you can indulge your indignation with perfect safety. Do you hear? With perfect safety. Directly as he had spoken she regretted these words. Really it was unreasonable to take Mr. Travers' tricks of character more passionately on this spot of the Eastern Archipelago full of obscure plots and warring motives than in the more artificial atmosphere of the town. After all, what she wanted was simply to save his life, not to make him understand anything. Mr. Travers opened his mouth and without uttering a word shut it again. His wife turned toward the looking glass nailed to the wall. She heard his voice behind her. Edith, where's the truth in all this? She detected the anguish of a slow mind with an instinctive dread of obscure places wherein new discoveries can be made. She looked over her shoulder to say, it's on the surface, I assure you. Altogether on the surface. She turned again to the looking glass, where her own face met her with dark eyes, and a fair mist of hair above the smooth forehead. But her words had produced no soothing effect. But what does it mean? Cried Mr. Travers. Why doesn't the fellow apologize? Why are we kept here? Are we being kept here? Why don't we get away? Why doesn't he take me back on board my yacht? What does he want from me? How did he procure our release from these people on shore who he says intended to cut our throats? Why did they give us up to him instead? Mrs. Travers began to twist her hair on her head. Matters of high policy and of local politics. Conflict of personal interests, mistrust between the parties, intrigues of individuals, you ought to know how that sort of thing works. His diplomacy made use of all that. The first thing to do was not to liberate you, but to get you into his keeping. He is a very great man here, and let me tell you that your safety depends on his dexterity in the use of his prestige, rather than on his power which he cannot use. If you would let him talk to you, I am sure he would tell you as much as it is possible for him to disclose. I don't want to be told about any of his rascalities. But haven't you been taken into his confidence? Completely, admitted Mrs. Travers, peering into the small looking glass. What is the influence you brought to bear upon this man? It looks to me as if our fate were in your hands. Your fate is not in my hands. It is not even in his hands. There is a moral situation here which must be solved. Ethics of blackmail, commented Mr. Travers with unexpected sarcasm. It flashed through his wife's mind that perhaps she didn't know him so well as he had supposed. It was as if the polished and solemn crust of hard proprieties had cracked slightly, here and there, under the strain, disclosing the mere wrong-headedness of a common mortal. But it was only manner that had cracked a little. The marvelous stupidity of his conceit remained the same. She thought that this discussion was perfectly useless, and as she finished putting up her hair she said, "Colin, I think we had better go on deck now." "You propose to go out on deck like this?" muttered Mr. Travers with downcast eyes. "Like this? Certainly. It's no longer a novelty. Who is going to be shocked?" Mr. Travers made no reply. What he had said of his attitude was very true. He sulked at the enormous offensiveness of men, things, and events, of words and even of glances which he seemed to feel physically resting on his skin like a pain, like a degrading contact. He managed not to wince, but he sulked. His wife continued, "And let me tell you, that those clothes are fit for a princess. I mean they are of the quality, material and style custom prescribes for the highest in the land, a far distant land, where I am informed women rule as much as the men. In fact, they were meant to be presented to an actual princess in due course. They were selected with the greatest care for that child Amada." Captain lingered. Dot, Mr. Travers made an inarticulate noise partaking of a groan and a grunt. "Well, I must call him by some name, and this, I thought, would be the least offensive for you to hear. After all, the man exists. But he is known also on a certain portion of the Earth's surface as King Tom. Delcasser is greatly taken by that name. It seems to him wonderfully well adapted to the man, in its familiarity and deference. And if you prefer..." "Dot, I would prefer to hear nothing," said Mr. Travers, distinctly. "Not a single word. Not even from you, till I am a free agent again. But words don't touch me. Nothing can touch me, neither your sinister warnings nor the moods of levity which you think proper to display before a man whose life, according to you, hangs on a thread." "I never forget it for a moment," said Mrs. Travers. "And I, not only know that it does, but I also know the strength of the thread. It is a wonderful thread. You may say, if you like, it has been spun by the same fate which made you what you are." Mr. Travers felt awfully offended. He had never heard anybody, let alone his own self, addressed in such terms. The tone seemed to question his very quality. He reflected with shocked amazement that he had lived with that woman for 8 years. And he said to her gloomily, "You talk like a pagan." It was a very strong condemnation which apparently Mrs. Travers had failed to hear, for she pursued with animation. "But really, you can't expect me to meditate on it all the time, or shut myself up here and mourn the circumstances from morning to night. It would be morbid. Let us go on deck." "And you look simply heathenish in this costume," Mr. Travers went on, as though he had not been interrupted, and with an accent of deliberate disgust. Her heart was heavy, but everything he said seemed to force the tone of levity onto her lips. "As long as I don't look like a guy," she remarked, negligently, and then caught the direction of his lurid stare, which as a matter of fact was fastened on her bare feet. She checked herself. "Oh, yes, if you prefer it, I will put on my stockings. But you know I must be very careful of them. It's the only pair I have here. I have washed them this morning in that bathroom which is built over the stern. They are now drying over the rail just outside. Perhaps you will be good enough to pass them to me when you go on deck." Mr. Travers spun round and went on deck without a word. As soon as she was alone, Mrs. Travers pressed her hands to her temples, a gesture of distress which relieved her by its sincerity. The measured footsteps of two men came to her plainly from the deck, rhythmic and double with a suggestion of tranquil and friendly intercourse. She distinguished particularly the footfalls of the man whose life's orbit was most remote from her own. And yet the orbits had cut. A few days ago she could not have even conceived of his existence, and now he was the man whose footsteps, it seemed to her, her ears could single unerringly in the tramp of a crowd. It was, indeed, a fabulous thing. In the half-light of her overheated shelter she let an irresolute, frightened smile pass off her lips before she, too, went on deck. Two uningeniously constructed framework of light posts and thin laths occupied the greater part of the deck amidships of the Emma. The four walls of that airy structure were made of muslin. It was comparatively lofty. A door-like arrangement of light battens filled with calico was further protected by a system of curtains calculated to baffle the pursuit of mosquitoes that haunted the shores of the lagoon in great singing clouds from sunset till sunrise. A lot of fine mats covered the deck space within the transparent shelter devised by Lingard and Jorgensen to make Mrs. Traver's existence possible during the time when the fate of the two men, and indeed probably of everybody else on board the Emma, had to hang in the balance. Very soon Lingard's unbidden and fatal guests had learned the trick of stepping in and out of the place quickly. Mr. Delcasser performed the feat without apparent haste, almost nonchalantly, yet as well as anybody. It was generally conceded that he had never let a mosquito in together with himself. Mr. Travers dodged in and out without grace, and was obviously much irritated at the necessity. Mrs. Travers did it in a manner all her own, with marked cleverness and an unconscious air. There was an improvised table in there, and some wicker armchairs which Jorgensen had produced from somewhere in the depths of the ship. It was hard to say what the inside of the Emma did not contain. It was crammed with all sorts of goods like a general store. That old hulk was the arsenal, and the war chest of Lingard's political action. She was stocked with muskets and gunpowder, with bales of long cloth, of cotton prints, of silks, with bags of rice and currency brass guns. She contained everything necessary for dealing death and distributing bribes, to act on the cupidity and upon the fears of men, to march and to organize, to feed the friends, and to combat the enemies of the cause. She held wealth and power in her flanks, that grounded ship that would swim no more, without masts and with the best part of her deck cumbered by the two structures of thin boards and of transparent muslin. Within the latter lived the Europeans, visible in the daytime to the few Malays on board, as if through a white haze. In the evening the lighting of the hurricane lamps inside turned them into dark phantoms surrounded by a shining mist, against which the insect world rushing in its millions out of the forest on the bank was baffled mysteriously in its assault. Rigidly enclosed by transparent walls, like captives of an enchanted cobweb, they moved about, sat, gesticulated, conversed publicly during the day. And at night when all the lanterns, but one, were extinguished, their slumbering shapes covered all over by white cotton sheets on the camp bedsteads, which were brought in every evening, conveyed the gruesome suggestion of dead bodies reposing on stretchers. The food, such as it was served within that glorified mosquito net which everybody called the age without any humorous intention. At meal times the party from the yacht, at the company of Lingard who attached to this ordeal a sense of duty performed at the altar of civility and conciliation. He could have no conception how much his presence added to the exasperation of Mr. Travers, because Mr. Travers' manner was too intensely consistent to present any shades. It was determined by an ineradicable conviction that he was a victim held to ransom on some incomprehensible terms by an extraordinary and outrageous bandit. This conviction, strung to the highest pitch, never left him for a moment, being the object of indignant meditation to his mind, and even clinging, as it were, to his very body. It lurked in his eyes, in his gestures, in his ungracious mutters, and in his sinister silences. The shock to his moral being had ended by affecting Mr. Travers' physical machine. He was aware of hepatic pains, suffered from accesses of somnolence and suppressed gusts of fury which frightened him secretly. His complexion had acquired a yellow tinge, while his heavy eyes had become bloodshot, because of the smoke of the open wood fires during his 3 days' detention inside Belarus' stockade. His eyes had been always very sensitive to outward conditions. Delcasser's fine black eyes were more enduring, and his appearance did not differ very much from his ordinary appearance on board the yacht. He had accepted with smiling thanks the offer of a thin blue flannel tunic from Jorgensen. Those two men were much of the same build, though of course Delcasser, quietly alive and spiritually watchful, did not resemble Jorgensen, who, without being exactly macabre, behaved more like an indifferent but restless corpse. Those two could not be said to have ever conversed together. Conversation with Jorgensen was an impossible thing. Even Lingard never attempted the feat. He propounded questions to Jorgensen much as a magician would interrogate an evoked shade, or gave him curt directions as one would make use of some marvelous automaton. And that was apparently the way in which Jorgensen preferred to be treated. Lingard's real company on board the Emma was Delcasser. Delcasser had met Lingard on the easy terms of a man, accustomed all his life to good society in which the very affectations must be carried on without effort. Whether affectation, or nature, or inspired discretion, Delcasser never let the slightest curiosity pierce the smoothness of his level, grave courtesy lightened frequently by slight smiles which often had not much connection with the words he uttered, except that somehow they made them sound kindly, and as it were tactful. In their character, however, those words were strictly neutral. The only time when Lingard had detected something of a deeper comprehension in Delcasser was the day after the long negotiations inside Bellerup's stockade for the temporary surrender of the prisoners. That move had been suggested to him, exactly as Mrs. Travers had told her husband, by the rivalries of the parties, and the state of public opinion in the settlement deprived of the presence of the man who, theoretically at least, was the greatest power and the visible ruler of the shore of refuge. Bellerup still lingered at his father's tomb. Whether that man of the embittered and pacific heart had withdrawn there to meditate upon the unruliness of mankind, and the thankless nature of his task, or whether he had gone there simply to bathe in a particularly clear pool which was a feature of the place, give himself up to the enjoyment of a certain fruit which grew in profusion there, and indulge for a time in a scrupulous performance of religious exercises, his absence from the settlement was a fact of the utmost gravity. It is true that the prestige of a long unquestioned rulership, and the long settled mental habits of the people, had caused the captives to be taken straight to Bellerup's stockade as a matter of course. Bellerup, at a distance, could still outweigh the power on the spot of Tenga, whose secret purposes were no better known, who was jovial, talkative, outspoken and pugnacious, but who was not a professed servant of God famed for many charities, and a scrupulous performance of pious practices, and who also had no father who had achieved a local saintship. But Bellerup, with his glamour of asceticism and melancholy together with a reputation for severity for a man so pious would be naturally ruthless, was not on the spot. The only favorable point in his absence was the fact that he had taken with him his latest wife, the same lady whom Jorgensen had mentioned in his letter to Lingard as anxious to bring about battle, murder, and the looting of the yacht, not because of inborn wickedness of heart, but from a simple desire for silks, jewels and other objects of personal adornment, quite natural in a girl so young, and elevated to such a high position. Bellerup had selected her to be the companion of his retirement and Lingard was glad of it. He was not afraid of her influence over Bellerup. He knew his man. No words, no blandishments, no sulks, scoldings, or whisperings of a favorite could affect either the resolves or the irresolutions of that Arab whose Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.